let's jump into our topic today. So we are still doing apologetics, still in that. And so we're going to be starting with a couple of weeks, basically looking at presuppositional apologetics. You can see the table at the top of your handout. We looked at this a few weeks ago, when I walked through just the overview of the whole project. So you see there how it compares with a classical, with an evidentialist. So presuppositional, right, the approach is basically experiential. What we're trying to turn people's attention to and turn your attention to is just what does your experience of the world around you tell you about what's true and real? So that first blank there, how does this go through reasoning? You know, you see classical, it's a priori, which is just Latin for before. Evidentialist is a posteriori, which just means after, right? And so then presuppositional, how does it do reasoning? It's more of an intuitive approach. The blank there would be intuitive, right? So it's basically this, when you just reflect on the experience of being human, what do you just intuitively know to be true? So that's what we're going to touch on. Then it looks at experience. The next one, the tools, right? Classical uses proofs. Evidentialist uses arguments. Maybe you remember the difference there. Presuppositional is going to use basically the idea of absurdities. Basically, it's a big exercise of taking, okay, these are the things you're committed to. If you're committed to all of those things, here's the absurd conclusions you have to come to. Does that make sense? It's saying, here are the inherent tensions of your worldview. And there's a difference there. It's not, maybe you've heard of the, kind of the idea of like a slippery slope argument, that if you do this, then later you'll end up doing this. Sometimes that's very, very valid, but this is not that. This is saying, if you believe this, this, and this, it is logically necessary that you affirm this. It's not a, you might someday end up believing this. It's logically, your beliefs lead to this conclusion, right? That's an absurdity. If these beliefs are true, then this absurd conclusion follows. And just the origin, what kind of, again, because all of these basically developed as responses to the prevailing philosophical worldview of the time. Classical basically comes within this kind of ancient and medieval approach to reason and logic. Evidentialist comes out of, you know, kind of this response to an Enlightenment empiricism. And then presuppositional basically comes out of the fruit of the Enlightenment of postmodern irrationalism. Basically, how do we engage a culture that is not committed to truth? That is not committed to the objectivity of truth. Presuppositional apologetics just says this is kind of our response to this. And some, you know, again, some people would put these as basically three totally kind of irreconcilable approaches to how you do apologetics. I like to think of them more like just different tools in your tool bag, right? Sometimes you need a hammer, sometimes you need a screwdriver, sometimes you need some dynamite, right? They're just different tools for different functions. And sometimes a hammer can get the job done that dynamite is supposed to do, but sometimes dynamite will be better. Anyways. Okay, let's jump in to the rest of the body. So first, what's the method of what we're gonna be trying to do? So I'm gonna do 2 weeks on presuppositional. Probably because it's just difficult to put a really fine point on what I'm trying to communicate here, at least for me. It's probably just not as processed in my own mind as it should be. So we're gonna do two weeks on presuppositional. And so this week I'm gonna do basically a really high level kind of broadside of just this entire worldview comparison that we're trying to do here. So method, what we're trying to do, the first blank there is tension. The method that I'm trying to do is highlight the tension between professed worldview and lived experience. To say, okay, atheist, secularist, whatever, here is your professed worldview, and here is how you are committed to living. Here's what you believe to be true about human life, or here's what your worldview requires you to believe about human life, and here's how your life actually contradicts that top to bottom. So we'll get into that. I put basically a page and a half from this book by Oz Guinness there. And so this is, I remember this, I read this back in 2019, and this just made things click for me in a really helpful way. So I wanted to just put this in front of you. Here is Oz. This is a really good book, Oz Guinness, Fool's Talk. Basically talking about how do you engage, he talks about, you know, Christian persuasion. How do you do Christian persuasion in a culture like ours? Really helpful book. It's not crazy long. Really enjoy it. Highly recommend that book. I have a short stack of 7 or 8 books that are kind of my go-to recommendations, and this is firmly on that list. Okay, so let me just read through this quote. I want to read the whole thing, because I think, and kind of comment on it as we go. I think he'll say it better than I can. Although I do have a diagram, that's me. Okay, let's jump into it. One way of summarizing the effect of unbelief is to focus on the inescapable tension and dynamic conflict inherent in unbelief. At the core of unbelief is ceaseless, unremitting, and inescapable tension and conflict. Unbelievers suppress the truth in unrighteousness, but it is still always the truth, so they can never completely get away from it. An unbeliever's view of the world without God may contain many deep truths and have all sorts of genuine merits, but that view of the world can never be completely true because the unbeliever will not accept God, without whom it will always be finally false at some points. Yet at the same time, the unbeliever's views of the world are never completely false because they can never get away completely from God and his truth. Unbelief is therefore always and inherently intention, and it can never escape this conflict. Basically, kind of taking both what they say they believe and how they live, there's always a mix of error and kind of an accidental truth. They live like they are created beings with meaning, with purpose, with destiny, even though in principle they deny all this. They live like they are human persons that can make free choices that aren't just conditioned by their synapses, and yet in principle they would deny that. All right, back to Oz. This explains why all human desires, longings, and aspirations point beyond themselves and toward God. The full range and depth of our desires are simply not fully covered by our unbelieving faiths and philosophies, and therefore they are not fully satisfied by what our unbelieving minds insist is true. Basically, a thoroughgoing secular perspective affirms certain things about the meaning of life, very empty things about the meaning of life, and yet everyone longs for more than just the material. Everyone longs for more than just what that worldview would put before them. Back to Oz. What matters here is the simple reason why the tension and the conflict are crucial for Christian persuasion. That's your next blank, persuasion. They explain this tension. They explain why we have a point of contact with every single human we could ever meet. This is really important. If everyone in the world accepted God's truth as it is, there'd be no need to persuade anyone, right? They'd all be Christians. Equally, if everyone could live consistently in a world they each claim, in the world they each claim is true, we would have no chance of persuading them. They would be in another world altogether. But because of the inherent tension between the truth and the falseness in all unbelief, there is always a difference between what the unbeliever asserts they are and who they really are. Who they really are. Basically, in every believer, in every unbeliever, there are firm commitments to things that are impossible on their worldview, required on the Christian worldview, and those commitments that are inconsistent with their worldview make it possible to have these conversations. If somebody could live consistently in an unbelieving worldview, Christian persuasion would be impossible. And yet nobody can. So it's possible. We'll see some people later on who got close to trying to live that out. Okay, continuing with Oz. So he says, we can take the understanding of this fundamental tension even further. If the logic of God's truth pulls in one direction and the logic of unbelief pulls in the opposite direction, unbelief will never face the full logic of either. Both destinations would be unthinkable, though for entirely different reasons, as both would mean the end of unbelief. The logic of God's truth would lead to God, and the logic of unbelief would lead to disaster. Unbelief, therefore, lives in tension between the two worlds. As Francis Schaeffer pointed out, and his whole apologetics turned on this point, the more logical a non-Christian is to his own presuppositions, the further he is from the real world. And the nearer he is to the real world, the more illogical he is to his presuppositions. There are, therefore, two poles in the unbelieving mind and heart, which I call the dilemma pole, and the diversion pole. The dilemma pole expresses the logic of the fact that the more consistent people are to their own view of reality, the less close they are to God's reality, and the more likely they are to feel their dilemma. The diversion pole expresses the fact that the less consistent people are to their own view of reality, the closer they are to God's reality, so the more they must find a diversion. Neither pole is necessarily closer to God, because unbelief, as unbelief, will not bow to God either way, but the people at either pole are relating to God and to their own claims to truth in entirely different ways. Expressed like that, it is obvious that most people would prefer to be closer to the inconsistency but comfort of the diversion pole rather than to the courage and consistency, but discomfort, of the dilemma pole. In other words, most would prefer to live as if God were there with all the benefits that makes possible, even though they deny God in both theory and practice. The reverse is harder to carry off, and for that reason, it is also rarer. Okay, I tried to condense that into a diagram at the top of the next page. So you see here the two poles, right? Reality, God's truth, Christian worldview, and secularism. Totally different. You see up at the top the diversion pole and the dilemma pole, right? So if somebody has a worldview that wants to affirm secularism, basically if their life moves closer to that, to kind of consistently living out that worldview, they move toward the dilemma pole, right? So in that sense, what are some of the things that we're talking about? We'll get into this more next week. But basically, a secular worldview cannot affirm things like any sense of free will, any sense of human agency and choice, can't affirm anything like a real objective morality, can't affirm anything like any real value to life, can't affirm even an identity of the human person. Right? So there's a fundamental reality that secularism has to deny. And so the more consistently someone lives towards that, the more they get into this dilemma, right? What Ozguinness calls disaster. You just can't live that way. But then most people, and this is why the curve isn't, the slope isn't even, most people who would affirm a secular worldview are going to live closer to the diversion pole. They're going to affirm things that would lead to the denial of all of those, and yet still affirm, my choices are real. They're going to talk a lot about their choice, human autonomy, even though their worldview says they're no different than a rock rolling down a hill, just governed by the forces of physics. They're going to affirm the reality of moral causes. Thank God they do. While at the same time affirming a worldview that would undercut all of it. And so they'll live in this, basically, they'll live in a way that they say, I want to live with all kind of the moral and personal trappings of God's existence while denying it, while at the same time denying it. Okay, so the goal of something like this is to make secularism clear. The goal of something like this is to make secularism clear, to show just how anti-human secularism is. To affirm a secular worldview is to deny the reality of human personhood. And so the goal here isn't necessarily to argue against it, but just to say, here's what secularism has to affirm. Here's where this belief takes you. Secularism is the negation of humanity. Secularism makes humanity and personality into an illusion. Into an illusion. I want to skip ahead to, I'll circle back to this, but I think it makes sense now to jump ahead a little bit. Flip to somewhere. You should see a heading that says Secular Dilemma and Distraction. I think this would make the most sense at the moment. Okay, so dilemma pole, basically this is courageous despair that Ozguinness has talked about. Courageous despair is your blank. Right, so this again, there's kind of the dilemma and the diversion. So within dilemma, there's basically just this one kind of option. So here are kind of four options for how a secular person can respond to these issues and live their life. So this is the dilemma pole, courageous despair. So a couple of quotes from Stephen Hawking, renowned astrophysicist, talking about free will, talking about the mind. He says, it's hard to imagine how free will can operate if our behavior is determined by physical law. So it seems that we are no more than biological machines and that free will is just an illusion. Right? This isn't me as a pastor saying, oh, this is what you guys have to believe. This is Stephen Hawking saying, this is what we believe. This is the logic of our conclusions. Here we are. He goes on, he says, actually earlier, he says, the reason we say that humans have free will is because we can't predict what they will do. Free will is reduced to a really complicated Plinko machine. I don't know where the coin's going to end up, so there must be some free will in this coin deciding where it lands. That's not free will. But what he's saying is it's a really, 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 really complicated algorithm. Although it is fixed and determined, we can't predict it. Therefore, we call that free will. Right? This is Hawking's account of the secular account of free will. Bertrand Russell, earlier, more of a philosopher, says, that man is the product of causes. This is kind of his summary of like, how do you live a life in this worldview? That man is the product of causes which had no prevision of the end they were achieving. Basically, this is all accidental and random. That his origin, his growth, his hopes and fears, his loves and his beliefs are but the outcome of accidental collocations of atoms. Right, no meaning behind this, totally random. It goes on, he says, only within the scaffolding of these truths, basically meaningless of life, only on the firm foundation of unyielding despair, cheery guy, can the soul's habitation henceforth be safely built. So what he's saying is, all right, fellow secularists, we need to stop kidding ourselves. We have to start learning how to build a worldview on unyielding despair. We have to give up all of these things. All of this is meaningless. All of this is accidental. All of this is pointless. That's where we got to start, and then we build from there. So this is secularism telling you this is our principles. And you'll notice a lot of these are older folks. Modern secularists have shied away from this language. So there's a book called Science and the Good that I would highly recommend. It's a really interesting, it just focuses on the question of ethics, right? Can there be an objective, non-conditioned account of moral meaning, of moral duties, of morality that points beyond the immediate on a secular worldview? And it's a great historical survey of this really ambitious project of secularists to try to come to a place where they can say, no, morality is meaningful and objective and real. And basically, this book just really traces out how they like move from we're going to find the source to there is no source to basically social engineering. We just kind of need to manipulate the masses to get people to move towards the ends that we just kind of want on sheer power. So it's really interesting. Published by Yale, interestingly. There's a lot of really interesting stuff published by some of those universities. But anyways, yeah, Science and the Good. Highly recommend that. Really interesting. If you pick it up, let's talk about it. Okay, Jean-Paul Sartre. No idea how to pronounce that. Not even close. All right, so a couple quotes from him. Life begins on the other side of despair. Compatriot of Russell there. And then Sartre again. Dostoevsky once wrote, if God did not exist, everything would be permitted. And that quote. And that, for existentialism, his view, is the starting point. Everything is indeed permitted if God does not exist, and man is in consequence forlorn, for he cannot find anything to depend upon, either within or outside himself. He discovers forthwith that he is without excuse. So, everything is permitted. Right, so all that to say, this isn't just me saying, here are some things that nobody's noticed, and this is my opinion of where this comes from. Like, this is the consistent secularists will tell you, when they're being honest, this is where this worldview takes you. This is where it has to take you. While we're here, let's look at the other answers. Diversion poll. So again, this is more of the like, we're going to affirm the meaning of human life. We're going to affirm these things. We're going to affirm human agency, morality, all those things. We're going to affirm that. We're just going to kind of ignore the fact. We're going to distract ourselves from the fact that that's just wildly inconsistent with our beliefs. So I thought about making this first one a blank, but it just seemed mean. Kierkegaardian existentialism. I'm sure you guys are familiar with that, so we'll move on. Who's heard of Soren Kierkegaard? Name you've probably heard before. Interesting guy. So he was a Christian who was trying to think through faith in light of some of the Enlightenment progresses of the Enlightenment. Went in some ill-advised directions, and in a lot of ways was the grandfather of someone like Sartre. Was the grandfather of this existentialism. That swallowed up so much of Western culture. So basically, let's see. This is the idea that reason leads me to despair, so I need to kind of set aside reason and choose to live in the world that God reveals to me. Right? I need to bracket off reason and live in unreason. So he's famous for the idea of the leap of faith. So you'll notice this is, there's a very strong... don't have time for this. There's a very strong secular understanding of what faith is along the lines of this idea of a leap of faith. They need to set reason over here and then just kind of leap into unreason, and that's faith. That's from Kierkegaard. That's baloney. That is not at all what faith is, right? And that's been so destructive to so many people who think that faith is, affirm this radically secular worldview over here, but just kind of choose to live like it's something else. Live like life is meaningful over here against reason over here. That is not true. That is not true. So Francis Schaeffer, commenting on this, The God Who Is There, again, wonderful book. If a rationalistic man wants to deal with the really important things of human life, such as purpose, significance, validity of love, he must discard rational thought about them and make a gigantic non-rational leap of faith. That's Francis diagnosing the Kierkegaard thing, right? That's not him affirming that. So there's just that, like, life is meaningless, and yet I choose to pretend that it's meaningful. That's really quite common, I would argue. Then there's social activism. Basically, there's no fixed order, so we can define meaning, order, social life, however we want. The blank there I would call this Plato politics. Right? There's no real order to human life. Human persons are random and meaningless, and so we can kind of manipulate human society however we want to kind of achieve our optimum society. Christian political and social thought argues from a fixed standard and to optimum ends. God has designed us as a corporate entity, and so there's a reality that we're trying to aspire to. Secular politics seeks to find meaning by making meaning, by asserting meaning. And then last is just kind of a distraction and kind of hedonism. And this is, you know, not just the guy that is just shooting heroin all the time, but also just the guy who's just like, I'm just trying to work my job and kind of have some fun on the weekends, and just I just don't want to think about these things. So I distract myself with sports and football and my car and vacations, right? So it's just the idea of just I don't want to think about these things. I'm just gonna, of course, life is meaningful. I affirm what I learned in high school, and I'm just not gonna think about it. Okay, let's jump back up to the story. Law and personality. Law and personality. So I remember this idea kind of clicked with me. I was reading a book one time. I can still picture where I was reading that book, because we were in the hospital and Susie was born like 3 hours before. So we were, you know, Heather had just had a baby and they were all sleeping. I was like, well, I'm going to spend some good time reading this book. It's called God and Philosophy. Oh, I can't remember who it was by. Anyways, really good. So, pretty short book too. Basically, in the world, we observe both law and personality. Both law and personality. So there are natural laws that appear to be fixed and regular. Right? There's a reason that you can calculate the strength of gravity. Right, there's a reason that you can calculate so many of these things, because there are these fixed laws that seem to govern the way that the universe works. And there are irreducible experiences of personality. Basically, you could reduce that to meaning and freedom. Meaning and freedom. So there are things that have meaning beyond just the facticity of the event. Beyond the weight, the heat, the temperature, the sharpness of a physical object, there's meaning attached to it. Right, someone in your family passes away, there's meaning there beyond just a physical dissolution of molecular bonds, as well as freedom. Right, there are choices that are made that aren't just the products of natural forces. Meaning and freedom, this is what I mean by personality. So historically, cultures have attempted to reduce one to the other. Basically, that means to explain one by the other. To say personality is fundamental, law flows out of it, or law is fundamental and personality flows out of it. So pagan cultures attempted to reduce law to personality. Basically, personality is fundamental, law is an illusion, or maybe better, an approximation. So they attributed all of the observed order to personal spiritual beings. The sun rose because the sun god made it rise. The crops grew because the fertility god was pleased with them. The storm came because the storm god was angry. So pagan cultures saw the world as fundamentally chaotic, but ordered not by law, but by personality. By personality imposing a certain approximation of regularity onto chaos. Usually some hero god defeated the chaos monsters and established order. In the ancient Near East, Marduk slays the dragon Tiamat and builds the world out of her carcass. Like, he kind of takes the jaw and splits it. And so there you got the earth and the sky. Pretty cool. For the Greeks, Kronos, the father of Zeus, defeats the Titans and locks them in prison. The Titans are the chaos monsters, and Kronos, the god of time, establishes order. For the Vikings, similar, Odin defeats the frost giants and locks them up. Interestingly, for Norse paganism, was deeply pessimistic. So in the end, to them, the frost giants win. Isn't that weird? Chaos wins to them. Which kind of explains a lot of those guys. They kill all the gods and chaos reigns forever. Anyway, so that's kind of the law is subordinated to personality, right? Law is just an approximation of what personality has imposed upon it. On the flip side, the more philosophical cultures are really usually subcultures, usually kind of the cultured elites at the core of some of these other cultures, attempted to reduce personality to law, to do the opposite. So personality is an illusion or an approximation, and law is fundamental. The later Greeks, starting with Parmenides and Heraclitus, but getting to its apex in Plato, attempted to see all personality, humans and the gods included, as necessary outworkings of ultimate principles. Personality, then, is just more or less refined attraction to the good or repulsion to evil, somewhat like magnets. So you picture a bunch of magnets lying on a table and someone swirls a big magnet around, they're going to move in kind of seemingly intelligent ways, or at least, you know, with some movement. To this kind of Greek perspective, that's basically what personality is, a more or less pure response to goodness and evil. The Hindus and the Buddhists took a similar, but even more radical approach. All change in personality to them that they observed in the world is an illusion. It's not even real. The magnets aren't even there. Suffering, pleasure, and human individuality itself are illusions. All is one. One of the kind of fundamental teachings of the books called the Upanishads is the idea that Atman is Brahman, which means the soul, Atman, is identical with the universal reality, Brahman. So in this Hindu perspective, there is no personality. Your individuality, your personality, your soul is nothing more than a kind of illusionary expression of the universal. The only reality is the one undisturbed, unchanging reality, the law. So personality is reduced to law. So why does this happen? This pattern has persisted because humans have a created desire to want to explain things. We want to understand the world we live in. Part of the dominion mandate that God gave us. So one way or another, every culture that has thought about this has realized that if natural law is what it appears to be, and if personality is what it appears to be, then they are irreconcilable realities. If they really are what they appear to be, they cannot be reduced to each other. The laws of physics can never undergird either choice or meaning. Physical properties cannot account for meaning. Something can never get heavy enough to all of a sudden be meaningful. Or complexity. I think that's where a lot of secularists would argue for meaning, is basically just through complexity. On top of that, like always comes from like, so fixed and regular law has to come from something fixed and unchanging. This is why personality can only ever accomplish an approximation of law. Let's see. And personality has to come from personality, something with intention and freedom. Personality can never emerge from law. No matter how many dominoes you stack up, there will never be free choice. No matter how hot the dominoes are, or how complex their arrangement, the dominoes will always act mechanistically and deterministically. There will never emerge personality. Trillions upon trillions of dominoes. See what I'm saying? If that is your personality, if that is how the mind works, there is no real personality. Personality has to come from personality. So two common paths for these cultures. Either we say law isn't what it appears to be, but really comes from personality, paganism, or we say personality isn't what it appears to be, but really comes from law, philosophy. In either case, all you get is an approximation. Hopefully you're seeing that that's important. The law of ancient pagans was just an approximation of regularity, since it rested on personality, and the personality of Parmenides and the Upanishads is only an approximation of personality. And this is important. So basically, most cultures, why do they do this? Most cultures have believed that if the universe is one, if there is observable harmony and unity in the universe, then it must come from a single source. It can't come from kind of two totally irreconcilable sources. Therefore, one has to come from the other. There must be an explanation for the unity of the universe. Am I going in and out a little bit? Should I do a pulpit? All right. Good enough. Which gets us to, of course, what you're thinking of, the strange case of Manichaeism. Isn't that strange?
Gnosticism. If you maybe heard of Gnosticism. So Manichaeism is kind of the apex of Gnosticism, the systemization of Gnosticism. So Gnosticism, Manichaeism, such an interesting case study. It's a weird exception that somehow proves the rule. It's the weird exception somehow proves the rule. So Manichaeism, it's basically a Persian religion that was really prominent in the Mediterranean world. So Augustine, if you're familiar with Augustine, was involved in Manichaeism for a good stretch of his life, early 4th century, 5th century, maybe. So what is this? So Manichaeism, let's see. Basically, Gnosticism and Manichaeism basically asserts two equal but opposite sources for the world. Two equal but opposite sources. Right, that are basically in tension. This is how they would try to explain the problem of evil, and this is the existence of conflict in the world. Two equal and opposed sources of reality. A good creator who is the source of spirit and personality, and a bad creator who is the source of matter and law. So they would see the regularity of law and the freedom of personality are two irreconcilable sources, two irreconcilable concepts that are also in tension, in combat with each other. Which is fascinating, but honest. I think it's consistent in its own way. It wants to say that both are real. So the Christian worldview is the first to actually be able to affirm the reality of both and ground them in a single source. To say that neither is an illusion, neither is an approximation. Both are fundamental and real. Natural law is what it appears to be and comes from God's unchanging will and nature. So the regularity of nature comes from God's unchanging nature. The law and the regularity of nature is fixed and stable. Not an approximation because it rests on something fixed and unchanging. And personality is what it appears to be because it comes from God's free and unfettered personality. Because God has real freedom and real meaning, he can be the source of real personality, not an approximation of personality. So jumping ahead a little bit, so where does this pay off? So AI, artificial intelligence, is an approximation of personality. At this stage, a bad one, likely going to become a better one, but it will always be an approximation of personality. So the Christian says that AI can never become true personality because you can't move by degree from law to personality. You can't start with law and slowly get more complex until you all of a sudden become personality. You can't move from degree, from totally inconsistent things. In other words, you can never, so if you, you could move, what does that mean? You could move by degree from a triangle to a square. See what I'm saying? You could make little changes, and eventually you have a triangle and make little changes and eventually have a square, right? You can never move by degree from a triangle to red. You see what I'm saying? You can never like make little changes and eventually it stops being a triangle and starts being redness. You see what I mean? Hopefully that's confusing because that's the same thing as trying to move from law to personality. This is what AI is trying to do, to make slight tweaks to the triangle and eventually become red. They're incommensurable, right? They can't be moved by degree from one to the other. But the secularist says that AI can become just like human personality because, to the secularist, human personality is just an approximation of personality in the first place. They would say that AI can become just like human consciousness because human consciousness is just an illusion. It's just a really, really complex mesh of dominoes in the first place. So, of course, a computer can become just like that. Yeah, it can. That's why I think it can probably become a much more convincing approximation, but it will always be an approximation. To the Christian, the difference between AI and human mind is a difference in kind, not degree. To the secularist, the difference is one of degree. Yeah, okay, so to secularism, personality is reducible to law, mind is reducible to matter. To secularism, law is fundamental, and personality is a rough approximation that has emerged out of matter. This is where the story comes in. To the secularist, life randomly emerged out of non-life, and then mind emerged out of non-mind. And in both cases, to the secularist, there is no real change in kind. There's no real change in kind. Life is just a label. In reality, again, to the secularist, life is just chemicals reacting and self-propagating in a complex but consistent way. There's no real difference between life and non-life at the most basic level. It's just a change of degree. And mind, in the same way, is just chemicals and electrical signals acting and reacting in consistent and complex ways. So the difference between a coin toss and a human decision is a difference in degree, not kind. You see that? I have two choices in front of me, A or B. There's a difference between a coin toss and a human decision, and the difference isn't just complexity. It's a difference in kind. It's not just, well, I'll flip 10,000 coins and take the average, which is what a secular view would affirm. See, again, Hawking, and here he is. So we'll skip down. We are over time. We're at 11:03. That's most of what I wanted to cover today. So why do I do that? What I'm trying to help you try to lay the foundation for is to help you start to see the difference between the worldviews that we're talking about, to see the tension inherent in a secular worldview. If somebody affirms a secular worldview, they're committed to a view that personality is an approximation that emerges out of law. That there's just gravity, electrical impulses, chemical reactions, and this is all choices are, reducible to natural laws. So we'll pick this up next week with the five tenets of secularism. I'll just give you the blanks. I won't even touch on this. I was planning on doing that. We're going to start with that next week. So here are five tenets of secularism. If somebody would quibble with this, I would say to move away from these tenets is to move away from secularism. So first is materialist cosmology. Materialist cosmology, all that exists can be reduced to matter and energy. The sum of reality is reducible to physical material and energy, of course. Second is mechanistic causality. All that exists or happens can be explained by material and efficient causes without regard to final and formal cause. We'll talk about that next week. Nominalist ontology. Nominalist, N-O-M-I-N-A-L-I-S-T. Nominalist ontology. Things don't have natures, only names that we ascribe to similar things. Natures only exist in the mind of the observer. The example I like to use, if you are familiar with like popcorn ceiling, and every so often you're like, if you're a kid, you're trying to fall asleep in your cousin's whatever basement, and you just can't fall asleep, so you're staring at the ceiling. Maybe it was just me. And you see in the popcorn ceiling, all of a sudden you start seeing faces, right? And you're like, oh, look, there's a face in it, or there's a dog in the popcorn ceiling. So that is to the secularist what everything is, what human nature is. It's just an impression that the mind makes on just random data, right? So that's the secular interpretation of natures, right? To say human nature, dog nature, to anything like that is to just say I'm seeing a face in the popcorn ceiling. I'm seeing a face in the cliff. Nominalist ontology, that just means name. Okay. Relativistic morality, no transcendent moral order. Survival and social custom are the only grounds of morality. Thus, morality is infinitely renegotiable. So long as survival is maintained, so long as society is on board, it is infinitely renegotiable. And then skeptical epistemology. Skeptical epistemology, we cannot access knowledge of things and causes in themselves, the noumenal, but only appearances, the phenomenal. The phenomenal. So this is really interesting, and this is the like little chewed on straw that upholds secularism. This idea of skeptical epistemology. But we'll talk about that next week. We're over time. Okay, you'll see the schedule for the next several weeks. Again, next week, college lunch afterwards. Let's end here. Hopefully this was somewhat helpful, and just kind of file this away. We'll circle back to some of it maybe. Just file it away. It'll bear fruit later. Just trust the process. Okay. Or maybe I'm not as sharp as I should be. Let's pray, and we'll be done here.